Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous women of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra, and Cleopatra's nose,
follow Legacy now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History. It's the Easter holiday weekend here in the UK. We got some public holidays, so I hope people are able to try and enjoy those, even though we're in very straitened circumstances here. So try and spend some time with family, I hope, or some time by yourself, which in my case sounds quite attractive. I spent plenty of time with family, I can tell you. Got my kids around the whole time at the moment, right, Zia?
Certainly, yes.
And they're pretty excited about the chocolate, the flow of chocolate that is about to engulf this house.
I can't wait for some more chocolate.
In the meantime, they're doing a lot of history. You're doing a lot of history with your grandpa, right, Zia?
Yeah. And I'm watching horrible histories.
She's watching a lot of horrible histories. She's learnt more from horrible histories than she has from her dad, I'll tell you that much. Let's test your grandfather's history. Are you ready? Zia. Mm-hmm. Zia. What red-haired queen, which king burnt the cakes that he was supposed to?
King Alfred the Great.
Name a castle built
Tower of London.
How do you know who I was going to say?
Because you asked me yesterday.
What, built by William the Conqueror?
Yeah.
All right. My mum said Henry the Second. What have you said then?
Dover.
Have I told you that before?
No.
That's right. Nice work. What else happened at Dover? Remember what else happened at Dover? Who landed at Dover and jumped into the spraying foam, leading his comrades up the beach towards where the Britons were defending? Remember, I told that story hundreds of times. Julius Caesar.
Oh, yeah.
Remember? The guy jumped into the water.
Oh, yeah.
Come on, sharpen up, girl. Anyway, so...
All right.
So this podcast is about Lord Byron, but it's actually not just about Byron. It's about his incredibly brilliant family. And the wonderful historian Emily Brand, who's been on the podcast before talking about love in the 18th century, is here talking about one of the most remarkable dynasties in modern British history. She's going to tell us all about why the apple did not fall far from the tree. There were heroes, there were villains, there were lovers, there were fighters. No one was boring in the Byron family. And obviously...
Like me.
Like you. And well, actually, I was about to say, obviously the real hero of this piece is Byron's daughter. Remember who was Ada Lovelace?
She was a person who invented a computer and she was a mathematician.
Pretty good. I'll give you that. So this podcast is all about that. If you want to hear more podcasts, please go to historyhit.tv. It's my new history channel. There are hundreds of hours of history documentaries, hundreds and hundreds of podcasts, lots of great stuff on there. If you use the code POD1, P-O-D-1, you will get your first month for free, and then you'll get the month after that for just £1 or euro or dollar. You're going to absolutely love it. There's plenty to watch on there. In the meantime, everyone, here's Emily Brand talking about Team Byron.
So Ada Lovelace place is Lord Byron's daughter.
Good to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's so cool. This is a monster. Okay, I've heard of Byron.
Yes.
I didn't know about the whole dynasty. So what is the dynasty?
Well, I think when most people think of Byron, absolutely. If they're not thinking of burgers, they are thinking of the poet, because he was such a famous character in his own time, huge sort of rock star, has this amazing reputation both for his writing and for his scandalous sort of exploits as well. But I wanted to shift the gaze a little bit just backwards. So my book starts 2-3 generations before the poet. So it's kind of a prequel, really. It's sort of the 1720 to 1798, which is when the poet inherits Newstead Abbey in Nottinghamshire as a 10-year-old boy. And then it just traces them through wars, through revolutions, a lot of sex scandals,
Well, listen, it's like the Joker. It's like the Joker for Byron. It's the backstory. Listen, I'm going to ask you to do this. Let's go. Let's get into it, right? Let's start the start. Who do you start with? And also, I feel a bit bad you started someone, because that means their dad was like super boring.
Who's dad?
The first person you go, this is awesome, this guy's so dramatic and sex scandally.
Yeah.
Why did you not? There must have come a point where you go, no, he's really boring, let's start here.
Well, actually, it was the very first thing that drew me into this whole story. Obviously, my history, research history, is in sort of love and sex and scandal. So the poet is obviously, he was constantly intruding on that sort of thing. But then as a separate avenue into this book, I came across this portrait, a Thomas Gainsborough portrait of this woman, sort of 30-odd woman, aristocrat, dated around 1760, and I just fell in love with it totally. And then when I was looking up information who this was, it turned out she was a Byron. She was the poet's great aunt, Isabella. So it was her that drew me into the story, actually. And then while I was sort of went down this rabbit hole of research, and I found out about her eldest brother, who was the fifth lord, and he was supposedly a wicked lord, and he was doing all these murders and all this business. And then the second brother had this amazing navy career and shipwrecked adventure, and I was just thought, I have to do something on a group biography on these three siblings. There were two others, but they just weren't as interesting. But so they don't feature so much. But so it was certainly these three amazing siblings that I just felt like I had to pull their stories together and tell it as one sort of dynasty, really, a saga.
Amazing. Okay, so we got let's start with the woman who you first, who was your entry point. Why was her life so interesting?
Well, what first drew me was obviously this portrait, and she just looks, I don't know how to put it, she just sort of intrigues me immediately.
But that's Gainsborough for you, man. I wish she painted me, I'd look intriguing, even me.
She's just, she's sort of really gazing very directly out. She's gorgeous looking. She's got, it looks like she's got lilac hair, which I just thought was great. It was a bit of, pink and pastel coloured hair powder did exist in those days. So I do think she did go for a bit of a statement hairdo there. But there wasn't very much out there about her at all. And so I had to start digging into proper archives without knowing if she was going to be interesting or not. Fortunately, there is a lot of her original correspondence to some of her friends, and crucially to her second husband, who was this meticulous bloke who kept their correspondence over the course of 10 years from them in this secret whirlwind engagement right through until they have this terrible separation and she's sort of refusing to sleep in the same bed as him and all this. So I was reading this correspondence, and it just gripped me totally.
But and you found that?
I've never seen it published anywhere.
That's so cool.
It was catalogued, which is how I came across it.
Oh my God, that's like a trek. You must have been, that must be so, to see someone in the painting and then to realise that there's a whole archive.
Yes, and then she's got a bunch of stuff at Castle Howard as well, which was, she became mistress of Castle Howard on marrying. So they've got a lot of, they've got the painting actually, and they've got a lot of her letters to her daughters as well. But she was just this brilliant, very headstrong, very romance-led woman. And I don't think you get that so often with 18th century women, where they're all sort of aristocrats anyway, where they're sort of abiding by their etiquette and going to ballrooms and doing what they're told and marrying Mr. Darcy and all this sort of thing. But she was desperate to find true love, and she was going off with men 15 years younger than her and well below her rank. And eventually she sort of elopes to the continent with a German con man soldier and tries to pass him off as an aristocrat very unsuccessfully and sort of lives in disgrace with the man that she loves. So, yeah, you know, she's not changing the world in the same way that maybe her brother John was, but... I just thought her story was great.
You've done that thing that so many wonderful historians are doing at the moment. You've just excavated an extraordinary, overlooked and forgotten female character from our history. That's so exciting.
I've been really, really pleased that I've been able to tell her story on an equal footing with her brothers. Because in the Byron family, you have these sort of great nicknames of the male characters, and they've got all these traditions and myths that have risen around them, but then Isabella tends to be totally forgotten, or people will just say, oh, she was eccentric, and that's it. So it's been good to be able to figure out why people were saying that about her.
So talk to me about her brothers then.
Yes, yeah, so I suppose her eldest brother, he was a year younger than her, William, and he became the fifth Lord Byron. And he, in the course of the 1820s and 30s, so we're talking after the poet's death, so long after William's death, he becomes the Wicked Lord, and there's this legend of this old reclusive lunatic who lives at Newstead and refuses to see people and has done the occasional murder and tried to murder his wife and all of these things. And you will find these stories at the beginning of most biographies of the poet, modern biographies of the poet as well. The same sort of things rattled out about him. So I wanted to get to the heart of what if that was true. I was wondering if I could maybe rehabilitate him a little bit. Turns out no, he was genuinely categorically awful, but he wasn't necessarily this sort of raving mad just murderer.
Just really unpleasant.
Yeah, just a horrible dude. Really.
So these three siblings remind me, they are the poet's uncles and aunts.
So you've got his grandfather, who's John,
yeah.
And then the elder brother is William, who is the fifth Lord, so that's the poet's great-uncle, and then Isabella is their sister, so it's his great-aunt.
Right, okay.
There is a family tree in the book, so okay, people...
Okay, so we got the fifth Lord is awful.
Yes, pretty much awful, yes.
And badly behaved in an interesting way, or just unpleasant?
Well, at the beginning of his life, he's got a reputation by... about the age of 25 for being a terrible coward, and all his neighbours are sort of saying, oh, he's got a very sad character in everything, is what one of his neighbours says. But in a sort of cowardly, embittered, very entitled, actually, is what I mean to say, an entitled way. As he progresses through his life, he just can't control his spending. He pursues an actress, to the point of sexual harassment, really. He has a sort of abducted and tried to convince to sleep with him, loads of affairs. And then the main point in his life where he becomes most notorious is when he gets drunk at a Nottinghamshire club dinner and has a dispute, a very boring dispute about sort of estate management with one of his neighbours. And then he ends up stabbing him through the stomach and killing this guy that he's known all his life. So he ends up on trial for murder at the House of Lords in 1765. So then sort of the Byron name there gets attached to this idea of dueling and villainy. And
does he swing for it?
He doesn't. There's a real feeling that he might, because 5 years earlier, another lord has been, that's happened to him for yeah. killing one of his servants,
yeah.
In this case, he manages to turn on the charm quite enough just to be able to sort of convince his lordly peers that he didn't kill him on purpose, it was an accident, and also he's got some quite high up relatives, sort of Lord of the Tower of London probably helps that he's got those connections. So he just gets a fine and gets sent home in a chair that day after he's acquitted.
In a chair. Mm. Okay, so and then dies a horrible, lonely old man.
Basically, yeah.
Right, yeah. What about the other brother?
So the other brother is John. His name, he's gone down in history as Foulweather Jack Byron. And so he is the poet's grandfather. And his is the only name and the only sort of legends that have risen up that I can trace to his actual lifetime, which I was really, really happy to be able to do because, you know, it proves that they weren't just all stories that were invented in the 19th century. But he went off to the Navy when he was 14. And then when he was 16 to 17, he was involved in this amazing shipwreck just off the coast of South America, and then a subsequent 5.5 year long journey of him trying to make his way up through Chile and then get back to England, encountering all these, anything that could go wrong goes wrong for him basically. So he gets his first fame as a 22 year old when he gets home from that story.
This is After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest, and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday, and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And the best nickname I've ever come across in history, Foul Weather Jack Byron.
Yes, we've got Foul Weather Jack, the Wicked Lord Byron, and then Mad Jack, who was the poet's father. But the Foul Weather Jack is the only one I'm going to definitively say he had in his lifetime, because that's the only...
That's very cool. I've actually heard of that story, but I knew it was a Byron, but I didn't know that was a relative of the poet. How extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. And the poet was super proud of his granddad. He never met him. John died 2 years before the poet was born, so he didn't know him. But the story seeps into Don Juan. There's a scene in Don Juan where the hero, it's just totally lifted. And the poet has to actually say something along the lines of, his sufferings were comparative to those related in my granddad's narrative. He has to name check his granddad, because otherwise everyone would know he's just stolen all the details. There's a good link there. He was very aware of that
story.
And
he went on to become an admiral, did he?
He did, yep. He rose steadily through sort of the ranks, I suppose. He after he got back, he got married, had a bunch of children. His poor wife was just constantly left. Every time he went off on a voyage, she was always 1 month pregnant. So she went through this on her own the whole time, every single time. But he sort of distinguished himself in the Seven Years' War, and then was promoted to, I think it was Rear Admiral, just before the American Revolution breaks out. And so he's sort of sent off to play his part, quite disappointing part in that war as well for him. And that was where we can trace his name, Foul Weather Jack, to, because every time he tries to sort of pursue this French fleet, the storm gets him.
Don't talk to me about those storms. We'd still be one big happy family, hadn't we, of the bad weather of the American war. Well, kind of. So then he has a son, Jack, who's mad.
He is called Mad Jack, and we have one likely very unreliable print of him. And this is sort of the first time when he explodes into the public scene, and that's because he's having an affair with a married marchioness, and all the newspapers are gossiping about it, and he gets a special sex scandal column in one of the magazines of the time.
But his dad's been absent a lot when he was growing up. I feel a bit sorry for him already.
I was looking at this. He was away for some of the time, but most of the time there's a good 2-3 year chunks where he's stationed in Plymouth, which is just down the road. So I think he's been framed as this absent father, but I think most of the time he's probably... unless he just didn't go home.
So Mad Jack is making a name for himself in all the wrong ways.
Yeah, he's from a very young age I think as a teenager, he's convincing his dad to let him have bits of inheritance early and then going off and spending it on swords and new jackets and stuff like that. So he knows what he's after in his life, and it's very quickly gambling and women. And I won't say he's mad, but he wasn't great either.
I want to say the George Best and the rest of it he wasted. How does he has the poet at some stage, does he?
Yeah, so he has this first marriage, actually, this first affair is so public, and this Lady Carmarthen, who he has an affair with, falls pregnant. She confesses to her husband, Lord Carmarthen, and he obviously throws her out. So these two quickly get married. I think she's 8+ months pregnant at this point.
Which, is that unusual in Georgian society, that there'd be an actual divorce and then a remarriage?
It would certainly have been very expensive. So I think, I don't know, I'm not sure why Amelia, Lady Carmarthen, would quite have done that, unless she was just besotted with Jack and felt like she had to be with this man. They've been having an affair for a few months. By all accounts, they were having a great time, as it came out in the sort of court case about it.
Do you get details on the court case?
Yes, so it's all transcribed. It's brilliant. It's all these tales. The servants are giving their testimony, and it's all, we heard them giggling behind the closed door, and when we went in, the sheets were very much tumbled, and we've seen him creeping around the house with no breeches on and all this sort of thing.
Right, well, that's pretty... It's brilliant. That's a smoking gun.
It's damning. It's very damning.
So they get married.
They have three children, of whom just one survives, and this is Augusta. And she's a very big figure in the poet's life later on. And then Amelia dies a year after that. Jack sort of rocks around spending money. He's done all right after this marriage because she was very rich and he's got some of that, or has benefited from that at least. He goes off to France. He stays with his Aunt Isabella, who's my Gainsborough portrait lady, gets some money out of her, spends that. I think that she convinces him to go back to Bath, to England, to find a new wife, which is what he does. He goes to the assembly rooms of Bath and very fashionable society of the time, and there he finds Catherine Gordon, who's a Scottish heiress, and this is the poet's mother. And within a matter of weeks, she's totally seduced. They get married in Bath, they don't even leave, and then the poet is born about 3 years after that. He abandons them fairly quickly. When the poet's 2½, he leaves. Money problems again, he's spent all of her fortune. Has a bit of an incestuous affair with his sister in France while he's living there, and then he dies.
He has an affair with his sister in France?
Yes, so it's a bit of a weird parallel in that obviously one of the things that the poet was most notorious for was having a sexual relationship with his half-sister, Augusta, Jack's daughter. But there's a lot of correspondence. It's at the Bodleian Library, and it is all of Jack's correspondence to his elder sister, Fanny Lee. It's very hard not to come to the conclusion that they were having a sexual relationship, unless he was just being a total weirdo in every letter that he wrote to her. But it's all full of, you are the most handsome woman I've ever known, and it makes me so mad that you are my sister. He gives tales of all these women that he's having sex with, courtesans and actresses and all of this, but then he'll make some really inappropriate comment like, I have been with all these women, but whenever I do anything extraordinary, underlined, I always think of you. So it's very much like...
Wow.
A bit grim reading, really. But his letters, they're always sexually charged, always really inappropriate. It seems that while they were in France, if not before, because they could have been doing this their whole lives and just the letters don't exist, don't survive. So that's a grim end to his story, really.
Okay, so. And so then the poet comes of age.
Yeah.
And is the poet's reputation for sexual... license, adventure. I mean, what elements of his reputation do you think are fair?
Probably most of it. I would say so. I think we've got such an amazing sort of survival rate of his letters. He was a prolific letter writer, and I'm sure there are many that haven't survived, but there are so many left, and it's you can see in them how he's presenting himself to different people and with different stories. And sometimes he just can't help but reveal a little bit too much about some affair that he's had with some woman. When he was at Cambridge at university, he and his friends had the sort of coded language for their sexual relationships with boys as well. So the sort of homosexual code kind of thing that they had for then. So it runs through his life, and he was generally quite terrible.
Here's the big question that we always ask us about Georgian, but also Victorian society, is like, to what extent is this family unusual?
Yeah.
To what extent are the kind of superficial customs that seem to govern social interactions within the aristocracy, within the just a sort of front for like you know, savage boozing and shagging? Like, what do you think? Do you think this family that you've managed to track is actually had something weird going on, or do you think they were pretty normal?
I think with the poet himself, obviously loads of attention is drawn to it because he's such a public figure and because he relished it so much. He liked to sort of be this enigmatic character coming into a ballroom and all the ladies start swooning because of they wish that he would ruin their reputation, sort of thing. With his ancestors, it was a self-professed era of bawdiness and boozing and all that, as you say. But they do come up with weird regularity in sort of these sex scandal columns. So Foulweather Jack, who's otherwise from...
Oh, not Foulweather.
From this perspective, he's quite the gallant character, but he turns up in this sex scandal column and everything's laid bare about his affair with a teenage chambermaid when he's in his mid-50s.
Right.
Okay. So there's no right proper goodies and baddies here. They're all sort of getting involved.
Well, there is maybe one goodie, who was Byron's daughter.
Well, this is true. She didn't have to put up with any of any of their nonsense, probably.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's probably beyond the range of your book, I guess.
It is. So my book, the poet kind of frames it, but it is the prequel to his life, and he turns up in 1798, and for the most part, that's the end of the book. But of course, these are all Ada's relatives
these
as well.
These are all Ada Lovelace, so for everyone who doesn't know, who was world's first computer programmer. Mm. She came up with the
remarkable
idea. Yeah, amazing. What a family.
They're great. I love them. I'm so glad to be able to tell their story in this way, I think for the first time. I mean, it's been done, sort of, there's been academic studies and there's been 2,000-year-long genealogical studies, but this is really getting to the nitty-gritty of how they viewed the century and lots of things that haven't been revealed before. So,
as someone who's obsessed with the 18th century, this sounds like a must-read. It's just a completely different take on it, and it's a lovely, lovely way through the century.
Thank you.
The book is called?
It's called The Fall of the House of Byron. It's drama. Sounds dramatic.
It does. Was it a fall? Was it because I guess were they rich, and then by the time...
They were fine. At the beginning, actually, the fourth lord, they weren't wildly wealthy, but the fourth lord had made Newstead this amazing mansion. It was very much admired. He'd been sort of a careful, cautious money keeper. So when the fifth lord inherits at 13, he's got a decent enough fortune. He runs through the whole thing and more. And then, by the end of the century, Newstead is literally a ruin because he's not been able to afford the upkeep for it. So
cool. Well, it's The Fall of the House of Byron, but it must have been a hell of a ride. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there, law of the jungle out there, and I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code Dan Snow at checkout.